This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There is plenty of evidence that drug use during pregnancy can be harmful to the fetus. Does that make using during pregnancy a criminal offense? And should the mother be jailed for it? While Tennessee is the only state to criminalize drug use during pregnancy, a number of states are going to great lengths to prosecute pregnant drug users on charges of everything from child neglect to felony assault. Olga Kazan examines a number of these cases in an article for The Atlantic called Into the Body of Another. Olga, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start in Oklahoma, and this is the case of Amber Brianna Smith. Tell us about the circumstances that led to her arrest and incarceration.
So Amber, like the other women in the article, is someone who basically she gave birth, and in the course of the birth, when she was drug tested and when her newborn was drug tested, they found methamphetamine in both of their systems. Essentially, this was evidence that she had been using drugs during pregnancy, and that is what led to her prison sentence for 6 years for felony child neglect.
And she pleaded guilty to neglecting her. This was her seventh child. Four of her seven children were also born with drugs in their systems. So clearly, this is not an isolated incident. Why was she thrown in jail for the seventh?
The way it was sort of described to me, this is not necessarily a specific law in the state where automatically if you're doing drugs during pregnancy, you get sent to jail. But it's increasingly sort of being considered, not just in Oklahoma, but in other parts of the country, as a form of child abuse. And kind of the sense that I got when I was interviewing people in the state was that, you know, how much were we supposed to take? You know, she had had so many children with drugs in their systems, almost as though she was a repeat offender, and that kind of played into why they decided to act on the seventh child in particular.
What is the legal framework for incarcerating a woman who used drugs while pregnant? Does it vary by state to state?
Yeah, and it does, and it's a little bit complicated, but basically Tennessee is the only state that makes it outright illegal. But in other states, it's sort of this, you know, it's being kind of applied under child abuse statutes, and that's what I found in Oklahoma and also in Arkansas, where some of the other cases that I looked at. You know, these women are being seen as harming their children, and so that's a form, according to the prosecutors in these states, of child abuse.
Well, it seems to be a pretty legal gray area. You mentioned Tennessee, the one state that explicitly criminalizes drug use during pregnancy. But how are states prosecuting mothers if there is no explicit law criminalizing drug use during pregnancy?
So in some cases, it's women who have violated their probation. So I looked at the case of another woman who was on probation, and the way that they discovered that she had violated her probation was that she gave birth and the child had drugs in his system, and so she was incarcerated. And then in Arkansas, I believe it was this other type of crime called introduction of a controlled substance into the body of another. And that is more for if a parent allows a child to get access to drugs or injects them with drugs, or for date rape drugs, or otherwise known as roofies. So it was as though she infused the baby with the drug through the umbilical cord.
In that case, this woman was tested because she was on probation, but who is tested and why?
So these areas where women are more likely to be incarcerated, they tend to test women who they think probably were doing drugs during their pregnancy. So it's someone who looks like they might be high, obviously someone who has a history of drug abuse, someone who has things going on with their placenta, that can be a sign that that they had used drugs, or you know, that they otherwise seem to be in distress. One of the women was just really screaming and crying a lot during her labor and seemed to be sort of acting erratically, so I think that might have triggered her test. Hospitals usually don't test everyone, and there are some signs, you know, in some places that African American and poor women are more likely to be tested.
So you brought up this case in Arkansas of Melissa McCann Arms. Now, tell us a little bit about the circumstances that led to her arrest and incarceration.
Hers was a very sad case. She was someone who had had a very sort of abusive childhood. She finally got married, and she really wanted to have a child. She had, you know, she told me she had seen fertility doctors and things like that. And, you know, she was kind of going along, but then her mother died, and she was very close to her mother, and that kind of was her support system. And she started using drugs. She started using meth really a lot after that happened. She sort of went on benders. Her husband left her. She met another man who was a really hardcore meth user, who's mentally retarded. And so during her pregnancy, she used meth four times, including the night before her son was born. So they did find drugs in his system. Actually, they made a plan for her to get better. The social workers in the area told her what she needed to do, that she needed to go to rehab and that she needed to get a house set up for her baby and, you know, go through treatment and go to meetings. She did all of that. You know, she got a trailer. She got all the baby supplies ready. But because the drug test took a year or almost a year to get back, her son was actually taken away. Or right as she was about to regain custody and a few months after she had started seeing him regularly again.
It is such a sad story. And she was sentenced to 20 years in prison for harming her child. What do we know about the long-term effects of children who have been exposed to drugs like meth or like heroin in utero?
So meth and heroin are a little bit different. Basically, the argument that I heard over and over again was that, you know, these women, from the prosecutors, was that these women are hurting their children because meth is going to permanently impact their babies. And of course, no one thinks it's a good idea to use meth while you're pregnant, or any drug. But meth in particular, it seems to be not as harmful as everyone thinks. There's a researcher, Barry Lester, who I spoke with a lot, who really has been doing a lot of studies on, you know, children who are exposed to meth in utero, and they really are not that much worse off. They do have slightly slower reaction times. They're a little bit more impulsive, and they have trouble following rules, but it's not the kind of thing where this child is going to be damaged forever. It's the kind of thing where if they have the right supports and they're able to, you know, get help from their school, they might bounce back and be just as good as any other child. And actually, some people think that meth is not as, or some researchers think meth is not as harmful as things like alcohol and cigarettes, which of course you wouldn't be arrested, you know, unless you really drink a lot, binge drink throughout your pregnancy, you wouldn't be arrested for alcohol because it's not illegal.
Well, beyond the health effects, what actually happens to the children when their moms are incarcerated after birth for drug use?
It's, you know, it kind of depends on the situation. And
with Amber Smith or Melissa Arms, for example?
So they had two kind of very different things happen. With Amber Smith, the social workers did do a great job. They actually put the child with their great aunt. It's actually Amber's aunt. And it's interesting because the aunt had also taken care of Amber when Amber was little because her mom was also incarcerated. And so the sort of kind of generational foster care system where this one aunt is taking care of, you know, multiple generations of children from this one family. But they seem relatively well off. You know, I think they're struggling financially, but I think that they're in a loving home. In the situation of Melissa, that's a little bit sadder, once again. Because she went to prison for such a long term, her son, who does have special needs because of some cerebral palsy that he has, he needs therapy and kind of constant help and a lot of attention. And he was getting that when he was staying with Melissa. But after she was sent away, her, I guess, now ex-husband, Joseph, got custody. And from what I can tell, Joseph does not have a home. He stays with relatives. He, you know, I can't really ascertain whether or not he's getting therapy. It seems like the baby a lot of times stays with a relative of Joseph who, you know, probably, hopefully is taking good care of him. But, you know, Melissa doesn't get to see him. And this is a baby that she wanted for a long time. Mm-hmm. None of her siblings get to see him. He might not, you know, really know her when she gets out because of this. So that is really a more dramatic situation where you have kind of a permanent disruption in that mother-child bond.
As addiction rates across the country soar, a number of states are attempting to protect children by jailing women who use drugs during pregnancy. But is incarceration the best approach? Olga Kazan poses that very question in an article for The Atlantic. So, Olga, Amber Smith and Melissa Arms have family members. They're caring for their children. What if there are no extended family members? Are children typically put into foster care?
In that case, foster care would be what happens. But there's, you know, it's really not clear that foster care is a lot better than living with a mom who had a drug problem and then recovered. Children raised in group homes, tumultuous foster care settings, those oftentimes is not a better situation for the child than living with a mom who is a recovered drug addict.
How is this issue of children being drug addicted or receiving drugs in utero handled in other countries?
Very, very differently. In New Zealand, the researchers that I talked to said it's really unthinkable for a child to be taken away from its mother just because the mother is a drug addict. There, they kind of put them in these facilities where the baby lives with the mom and they kind of recover together and she gets to see the baby and she goes to treatment. And then there's other programs. If the children are older, then they treat the parents and the children and they all go on these like horseback riding trips together to try to kind of bond together as a family. So there are other approaches to this. And in other countries, you know, prosecutors just don't have the ability to bring cases where it's a woman accused of harming her own fetus. You know, it's not the law in some of these states.
Well, I wonder about the nature of the law, whether it's, you know, punitive in the case of Melissa Arms. You know, she was getting better, but she had to be punished for what she did rather than rehabilitation. In our country, in our culture, there's this changing status of the fetus. You know, we know that the viability of fetuses can be younger and younger. And there's this movement to divine personhood of fetuses that some charge is designed to encroach on abortion rights. Now, what do you think is behind this increasingly legalized framework for declaring the fetus a child that can be harmed?
In some ways, I do see echoes of the personhood movement in this. Of course, none of the prosecutors or people who are proponents of putting addicted mothers behind bars would say that this is a personhood argument for them specifically. But, you know, you do see evidence that this is sort of part of a gradual cultural movement of, you know, you can see the sonogram from the time, you know, the baby or the fetus is very small and you can kind of see it developing and it gets people wondering, you know, what are the impacts? What are the harms of any kind of substances entering the womb? You know, I do think it's part of this sense that we have to speak for this fetus, you know, even before it has a voice. We have to protect it even before it's a person. I can definitely see that argument as well. And I do think that's becoming more prevalent.
Well, looking at the comments in response to your article, there's some very intense reaction indicating that this is a pretty easy population to hate or be angry at. You know, the women who take drugs when they are pregnant, possibly harming the fetuses. Some people were suggesting, you know, there should be forced sterilization of people who are drug addicted and have children, or sterilization in response to prison time. What do you think are some of the answers to this or ways of dealing with this that, I don't know, sound a little bit less draconian and a little bit more positive?
I mean, poverty is really at the root of a lot of these things, and I think if some of these women had better supports and help in their lives before they even got on drugs, that might be one step. You know, I think it's hard for me to just sort of prescribe exactly what to do, because I think a lot of these problems are so systemic. Possibly, you know, talking to them about long-term reversible birth control from an early age, which is something that doesn't often happen in some of these states. You know, maybe showing them that there's another option if they don't want to have quite so many kids, you know, if they are struggling with addiction. So that's if they are already addicts. But there's also, you know, evidence from these other countries, New Zealand and elsewhere, that show how, you know, with a lot of resource investment, there is a way to help drug addicts rehabilitate, you know, without separating them from their kids and certainly without putting them behind bars. A lot of the mental health agencies in the states where I was looking said that they don't have enough resources to treat everyone, that there are waiting lists. The women that I interviewed said they did try to get into treatment, but they faced waiting lists. And so I think as long as they're, you know, you're a drug addict and meth is a phone call away and treatment is, you know, a month and a half away, you're going to choose the meth. You know, I think something needs to be done with the way we address mental health and addiction before it gets to a punitive stage.
Olga Kazan, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Olga Kazan is a staff writer for The Atlantic, where she covers health, and there's a link to read her article, Into the Body of Another, complete with a number of charts and a number of really interesting comments, that can be found at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. The U.S. incarcerates six times as many women as it did 30 years ago. Many are already mothers, and 4% of incarcerated women enter prison pregnant. What happens to babies born in the correctional system or children left behind as their mothers serve out their sentences? Audrey Quinn of Life of the Law brings us the story.
Diana is a 23-year-old from Queens, New York.
I was on my way to get a sonogram for the baby. The minute I turned on my car, they told me to get out the car. They put the handcuffs on me and took me in.
Diane asked us not to use her last name. In January 2013, she found herself in a jail cell at Rikers Island, 7 months pregnant.
They told me that I was under arrest because of what my boyfriend did.
Her boyfriend had sold drugs to an undercover cop. Now Diana faced a felony charge as an accomplice. Her main worry at Rikers was about her baby.
I was just thinking the crazy things that would go on if I was to give birth in there. I just thought, you know, honestly, that they would take the baby away and either a family member had to pick him up and take care of him or the system took him. I was really scared. I didn't want my baby to be born in jail.
Diana found out later that pregnant women at Rikers, they get taken to a hospital to give birth. But she didn't know that while she was in jail. Until the 1950s, most states had programs that allowed newborns to stay with their mothers in prison. These are called prison nurseries. Now there are hardly any programs like these in the U.S. Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in upstate New York, it has the oldest prison nursery in the country. Here, about a dozen moms live with their babies in a separate wing from other prisoners. A Department of Corrections study found having a baby in a prison nursery, it makes a woman twice as likely to stay out of prison later. Mary Burns, a professor at Columbia University School of Nursing, she tracked the progress of children who started off life in the Bedford Hills prison nursery.
The children are, for the most part, in their grade for their age level and doing well in school. And their parents send us pictures and report cards unbidden and letters and are really so very proud of their children's achievements.
But there's only about 135 prison nursery spots in the whole U.S. correctional system. That's nationwide. Which means, for all intents and purposes, a baby born to a mom in a U.S. prison is a baby that will not know his or her mom, maybe for a long time. Georgia Lerner leads the Women's Prison Association in New York. She says we shouldn't be asking prisons to provide support for moms and babies.
They are not really places that are supposed to be schools, medical hospitals, child care facilities. They were not designed to provide all of these services.
Instead, Lerner and the Women's Prison Association focus on keeping women out of prison when possible. People like Diana. After 7 weeks at Rikers, she got out on bail just before she gave birth to her son.
That's where I sleep and that's where he sleeps.
Say hi. Say hi.
Diana's been in the Alternative to Incarceration program for 2 months now.
Honestly, yeah, I thought it was just going to be about jail and drugs, but it's not, you know, it's more so learning about yourself and listening to other stories, you know, so I really like group. I honestly wish it wouldn't even be over.
Diana's support group meets every Friday. She also meets with her counselor 3 times a week. The baby's father got sentenced to 9 years upstate. Diana and the baby visit him every couple of weeks. Her counselor's helping her get financially stable. She's applying for jobs in retail.
Just had an interview today, so we'll see how that goes.
She's also thinking about going back to school. But for now, Diana says she just feels lucky to be with her son.
He makes my day just go by faster and exciting, I guess. He doesn't really cry much. He's just a happy baby, so I guess I'm blessed.
For Life of the Law, I'm Audrey Quinn.
Andy Orlando Wilson's golden rule of how to survive a kidnapping is pretty simple. Don't get kidnapped. Wilson is head of Risks Incorporated, one of a number of courses designed to prepare would-be travelers on how to not be abducted and what to do if you are. It is part of what one newspaper has dubbed the hostage industry that is growing in tandem with the rise in international kidnappings. These insurance companies, negotiators, lawyers, and security firms are pulling in an estimated $1.6 billion per year. Mitch Moxley is a writer and editor living in Brooklyn and recently took Wilson's 3-day course as part of a collaboration between Slate and the travel journal Roads and Kingdoms, and joins us now to tell us what happened. Mitch, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So you've done some reporting in North Korea and Haiti, wrote a book about China. Did you ever feel threatened with kidnapping? Is that why you took that course?
Actually, no, not at all. I took the course, I traveled to Haiti and, you know, kidnapping was never something I really even considered that would happen to me. It wasn't until I, you know, found this course and took it that I even thought, you know, this is, you know, something that people actually face when they're out reporting in certain places.
But kidnappings seem to be growing, or maybe we've just seen these highly publicized events like the beheadings by groups like ISIS. Has that just made us more aware of them?
We tend to only hear about the more high-profile ones. I do think recently, because it's become such an issue in Syria and also in, you know, Nigeria and North Africa, that people are a lot more aware of how significant this kidnapping crisis is. But definitely in the last 10, 15 years, you know, Iraq, obviously, Afghanistan, Mexico, South America, kidnapping for ransom has become a major business worldwide, basically.
And you write that you don't even have to be a wealthy person to be kidnapped.
It was one of the first things that Andy said to me on the course is that they'll kidnap you for next to nothing. In North Africa, migrants who are trying to get to Europe, for example, will be kidnapped for, you know, a few thousand dollars.
Well, tell us about this Andy Wilson, the founder of Risk Incorporated. What is his background and why did he start this company?
Andy is from the UK and he served in the British Army and he was in Northern Ireland and Cyprus. And after leaving the Army, he went into private security and he's been in private security, I think, for 2 decades or so. And he's traveled quite widely for security purposes and, you know, had sort of picked up on the trend of international kidnappings. You know, he realized kind of how big of a threat this was and saw that there was a bit of a, you know, an audience who might be willing to take some of these courses. As a matter of fact, he's, you know, Risks is one of several companies who are doing this now. When I was first researching this article, I found probably 24 companies that do this. This one course I found, they take people out into a forest and they do a mock interrogation. They, you know, put the students, their heads in pillowcases and then tase them and spray them with pepper spray. So some of them can be a little bit crazy. Most of them are sort of in a classroom where you learn the nuts and bolts of security. The Risks course was mostly classroom, but then with some sort of field exercises as well. So it was a little bit in the middle.
Who are his clients?
Well, his clients are international business people, people in the security industry. I spoke with a lawyer in Manhattan who had taken his course. He had a yacht captain take it once. In the class that I was in, it was me and another student. I called him Tommy in the story. It's not his real name. He lives in South Florida, and he works in real estate. And he's definitely struck me as being one of these very kind of security-obsessed individuals. He was, you know, worried about his safety. He had taken a number of firearms courses, and he considered this course a Mother's Day gift to his wife so he could learn how to better protect his family.
He seemed like a pretty troubled guy. You said he didn't look like he got a lot of sleep.
Yeah, I mean, he was a bit of a character for sure. He seemed to be, you know, dealing with some issues, and I'm not sure this course in particular was really helping him out. I think the course is, a course like this is much more kind of beneficial for somebody, you know, like a journalist or a business person who works in, you know, a potentially dangerous country.
We're talking with Mitch Moxley. He's a writer and an editor who attended a 3-day course on how to survive a kidnapping and wrote about the experience for Roads and Kingdoms and Slate. So you took the 3-day course. What happened on day number one?
Well, day number one, Andy picked me up, briefed me sort of on what was going to happen at the course. We went to an office that he had rented. He sort of ran us through the nuts and bolts of personal security and then sort of presented this pretty ghastly slideshow of kind of horror stories in Mexico and elsewhere. I was at that point kind of confused about what the whole point of this was, but he later said that basically he's trying to, you know, scare his students into being aware of what can happen to you if you end up in one of these situations. We did a surveillance exercise where we put some of the things that he was teaching us in the class to test. So we went to a mall, and he instructed Tommy and I to follow him. So we acted as if we were the kidnappers and he was the target, and spent about an hour and a half walking around the mall, sort of observing where he was going, trying not to get spotted, trying to look inconspicuous. And so that was day one. That's what it was, a little bit classroom, a little bit of field exercise.
Did you ever get the feeling walking around this mall or driving around Miami that, I don't know, it might have been more like adventure role play than actually preparing you for a possible hostage situation?
The whole thing was kind of a surreal experience, you know, from the kind of morbid photos we were looking at to these weird sort of things that we were doing all around Miami. It was definitely kind of an adventure. I was probably having a little bit too much fun with the whole thing. But I did, you know, pick up, you know, some good advice that I, you know, would practice if I'm ever on a reporting trip in a place like that again.
If you do break his first rule and get kidnapped, what are some of the things that you should do immediately?
Well, the most important thing is, according to Andy, is to, you know, to stay calm at initial period of the kidnapping, because that's when sort of adrenaline is going to be really high, when, you know, violence is most likely to occur. You don't want to be in hysterics. You want to be as calm as possible until, like, everything kind of settles a little bit, at which point, you know, over the course of time, you try to sort of humanize yourself to your captors and try to make them think of you as a person and not just, you know, a statement or money.
Some of the preparation courses that you mentioned do give you experience in some kind of torture. You said, you know, dropping you out in the woods with a pillowcase over your head, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But Wilson did tell you that there's no point or no way to be prepared for torture. You just can't do that sort of thing. But after the course was over, you asked him to waterboard you because you wanted to know what that was like. Now, you're not the first journalist who'd been publicly waterboarded. I think Christopher Hitchens famously was. Why did you want to do that?
Well, it was a bit, you know, kind of foolish of me to think this, but, you know, you're right. I just wanted to get some idea, even if it was sort of a small and superficial idea of what it would actually be like to be a hostage. And Andy, throughout the course, had kind of said to me, like, there's no point in doing that. You can't simulate what it's like. But I still, you know, nevertheless wanted to sort of experience something like that. So Andy and two of the people he works with took me to this paintball park where one of them worked and performed a very brief waterboarding. And at the end of it, he's like, you know, you see what I mean now? Like, you can't really prepare. And I absolutely understood. Like, it was the most kind of terrifying experience that, you know, I'd felt in a long time. It was the panic leading up to it was just, you know, horrible. Like, I knew I was in control. I knew I could stop it whenever, but you kind of get overruled and you start thinking, like, oh, something's going to go wrong. Like, I don't really know these guys. And yeah, I mean, the main thing I took from that is that absolutely there's no way to prepare for anything like that. It's just, it's beyond what any of us can comprehend.
So what did you take away from the course? The memory of that waterboarding or other things?
You know, I think I know people, some people are going to be skeptical of a course like that. And I entered the course with a fair degree of skepticism as well. But I think Andy's right in that you really need to focus on the prevention aspect because, you know, after you've been kidnapped, there's no rules to it. You know, you've been kidnapped. I interviewed a negotiator. This interview didn't make it into the story, but, you know, he said that a lot of people think, well, the kidnappers, they're going to treat you all right because they see you as, you know, a commodity and they want to make money off you. You don't want to hurt the good, so to speak. But the reality is these are criminals. Like, they're completely unpredictable and there's no guarantee you're going to be treated well. And Andy really stressed that throughout the course. And that doesn't mean that you need to become like Tommy and be completely paranoid about security. It's just more about having some awareness, you know, about where you are, what you're doing, in order to sort of protect yourself as much as you possibly can.
Well, Mitch Moxley, thank you very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We talked to Mitch just now about his experiences at a 3-day hostage camp. It was a collaboration between Slate and the travel journal Roads and Kingdoms. You'll find a link to read the article yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Mitch is also author of Apologies to My Censor, The High and Low Adventures of a Foreigner in China. Long before the biography of Steve Jobs hit the bookshelves, rumors about his, shall we say, disagreeable nature as CEO of Apple rippled through the business world. He was a highly successful businessman whose company fetched outrageous prices for a single share. Meanwhile, Apple products were changing the way that the world perceived the personal computer. Jobs appeared to prove the hard evidence that CEOs and corporate ladder climbers have been looking for. Maybe it does pay to be a jerk. And yet for every example of a successful, hot-headed leader, there's a counterexample of a nice boss that casts a shadow of a doubt. So our next guest went in search of scientific proof. Jerry Useem has covered business and economics for Fortune and the New York Times, among others, and we found his article, Why It Pays to Be a Jerk, at The Atlantic. Jerry, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you jumped into the deep end of this time-worn debate. Is there actual proof that favors jerks over nice guys?
Yes. There's one study out of Notre Dame. This is not even mentioned in the article, but it finds that not-so-nice people earn, for men, they earn about 18% more than very nice men. For women, there appears to be a slightly smaller benefit to disagreeable behavior. It's about 5.5%, which raises a whole other set of questions about gender and, you know, how far you can push it as a woman versus a guy. But that's some very concrete evidence. And we saw a number of other studies, for instance, in luxury retailing, salespeople who treat customers condescendingly, sort of shabbily, actually get shoppers to pay more.
So it's not quite unequivocal proof, but a couple of good studies. You, however, seemed a little unconvinced in your article.
Well, there's conflicting evidence out there, and that's sort of why we set out to do the story. A book came out by a guy named Adam Grant at University of Pennsylvania called Give and Take. And it basically makes the case with a lot of credible evidence that being nice over the long run is what gets you ahead. But we still have suspicions. And in effect, what about Steve Jobs? It's very clear if you read his biographies that he had a sense of entitlement and could be very hurtful to people. And so where we came out, I mean, in synthesizing the two sides of the story, I think there is a nice line to walk, which some people call tough but not toxic. There's some corporations, Intel is a very good example, where they have a culture they call constructive confrontation, where you basically are allowed to challenge people, expect to be challenged. There's not a lot of niceties, but you don't attack the person personally, and you're not doing it in a way that gratifies your own ego. That's the big distinction for me.
All right, well, let's dig into this a little bit. Other animals, they don't have to struggle with determining who's in power. I mean, humans have a unique quality that makes it a little bit more challenging. Tell us about this concept of prestige, and how does that factor into our perceptions of power?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. There's a fairly new field called evolutionary leadership, and it starts off by looking at other animals and how they determine pecking order, hierarchy. And it's all basically has to do with fear. Who's the biggest? Who's the strongest? And humans are alone among animals in that we will defer to someone because they're more capable, because they're more competent. The interesting thing, though, is how do we determine who is more capable and who is more competent? And that's where some other studies about overconfidence and sort of your bearing shows that we actually misread how capable or competent people are based on some external cues, a lot of which have to do with basically acting like a jerk.
Hmm. So in the animal world, the alpha is obvious. But what I'm getting here is that it takes a little bit more puffery for an office worker to sort of project that they are great.
Yeah. I mean, if we hadn't changed fundamentally since prehistoric times, our leader would be the biggest, fiercest, strongest guy. It would be Floyd Mayweather. But in terms of office politics, no, there's not a fear that you're going to get punched in the face by a colleague for saying the wrong thing. But there can be such a thing as sort of, you know, reputational aggression where you make someone look stupid. Researchers at University of Amsterdam did a really interesting set of studies where they asked, well, let's take the saying power corrupts. What if the opposite is true? What if breaking norms, breaking little social rules actually elevates you to power? And they found that, in fact, yes, that goes on. When we see someone putting their feet up on the table, taking the last donut out of the dish, interrupting someone, invading your personal space, we as humans have a tendency to think, wow, that person must be really important, or they must be really good at what they do, or else they wouldn't try to get away with that. And we end up elevating them without even thinking about it, precisely because of that behavior.
So as long as it benefits the group, is stealing the last donut is perceived as okay?
Well, the people who are most effective, and that's a great question, these Dutch researchers took the next step, and they found a mild benefit to this kind of behavior. But they found what was really effective is when people broke the rules on behalf of the group. If they didn't just steal a cup of coffee for themselves, but they stole a whole pot of coffee and dispensed it to the group. And it sort of rings true when you think about leaders like this, people who worked for Steve Jobs. There was an intense devotion. And when it came to going to bat for the organization, nobody could do it better than Steve Jobs.
You said that he was entitled. Now, why does that kind of narcissism, and I'm going to use that as a substitute for a word that we cannot say on the radio that you use in your
sure.
article, and why does that seem to be an indicator of success for people in power?
True narcissists are people who, they'll take special privileges in situations that other people wouldn't, out of just an entrenched sense that they deserve it. I was talking to someone who talked about a jerk in their division of the company they work in. They said, yeah, no one really likes the guy, but when it comes to vying for resources with other divisions in the same organization, he becomes sort of our jerk. He really truly believes that this division deserves the resources more than anyone else. So oddly, the narcissistic personality type, these people tend to rise to the fore.
Hmm. Well, we're setting this up in a very sort of oppositional way, you know, be nice or be a jerk or be a giver or a taker. But what if you are known as a giver or a nice person on the job? Can you do a sort of 180 and become an aggressive taker by practicing faking it till you make it or other kind of techniques or vice versa?
These academic studies that we're talking about, they use very rigid categories talking about personality types. And it leaves open the question, to what extent are we stuck in a personality type? And to what extent can we mix it up a bit? And the research out there suggests that you can mix it up a bit. For instance, when we go into a salary negotiation, we have a tendency to act more like takers. And that will be tougher, more sort of put our interests first and foremost. And one way of doing that, if you feel like you're too nice at work, think of other situations in which you're a little bit tougher, a little bit more assertive, try to import that into another situation.
So based on these studies that you looked at, you have a bottom line for yourself that you walked away with, you know, the best approach for getting ahead in business.
To me, the most effective people in business are tough and humane. They're both. When they need to be, when the situation calls for it, or when the group needs it, they are willing to throw some elbows. There's a book out there, came out fairly recently, called The Upside of Your Dark Side, and they argue for what they call emotional agility, using your full range, a fuller range than just sort of your default personality characteristics. And I think the most effective people in business are able to do just that.
Well, Jerry, thanks for the lesson.
Thanks for having me.
Jerry Useem, his article, Why It Pays to Be a Jerk at the Atlantic. And obviously, there's a little more subtlety than that title might suggest. You'll find a link to read the article for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. If somebody is known as the jerk at work, it'll show up on their performance review, right? Not likely, say two management researchers. Lilia Fuchen reports that their new study highlights the consequences of rudeness in the workplace.
This is Michael from the television show The Office.
Show of hands, who here has been the butt of a joke that has gone too far?
He's leading a session in sensitivity training.
Phyllis.
Michael, you make fun of us every day.
Every single day.
You never said anything.
We have, countless times.
Well, it is hard to tell the difference between you guys saying, stop, because I want you to stop, or stop, as in, stop, you're making me laugh so hard, you are on a roll, I am busting a gut. Stop!
This is exactly the kind of behavior that intrigues two faculty members at Radford University. Professor Danielle Kunkel teaches management at Radford.
Incivility is this idea of people being rude to people at work, and it can be inconsiderate behavior, it can be disrespectful behavior, or I'm condescending to you. While it's considered a behavior we don't want at work, it's not considered an illegal or sanctionable behavior.
Technically, rudeness isn't against the rules, so a lot of people get away with it.
People can discard it by saying, well, the person, the target, was being too sensitive, or I didn't mean it that way. The problem is that this is causing a lot of issues within the workforce.
Kunkel says some victims are shattered by the experience.
Everything from withdrawal behaviors, where they don't want to come to work, they're not putting their best effort forward. They may call in sick to work more often. They may hide in their office and close the door. They may not want to interact with other people at work. And if we have employees that are disengaged, that impacts a company's bottom line and profitability.
Dan Davidson teaches business law at Radford, and he co-authored the recent study with Kunkel. He says performance reviews are the net that we should be using to catch and correct incivility at work.
We're measuring performance, but we're not measuring personality and interaction. If someone is very productive, for example, a salesperson, and every month he exceeds his quota, the company's quite happy with him. But at the same time, if he's insulting and belittling his colleagues, causing them to not perform up to their optimal level, the company's losing with them. They're not reaching their quotas.
Davidson says we need to be asking a different question.
It's not just how many sales did you make. It's what kind of total worker are you? Are you the sort of person we want to keep with the company?
If we can include this in people's performance reviews, then we as an organization are sending a signal that we are not going to allow or accept this kind of behavior in our organizations, and we take it seriously.
So why should employers interfere?
We spend more time of our life in our workplace than we do in any other aspect of our life. When someone's incivil, the natural reaction is for someone to retaliate against that person. So if you're incivil to me, I'm going to be incivil to you. And it's going to go back and forth. And eventually, it could escalate to one of these higher level pieces like bullying or aggression, or even sexual harassment, something along those lines.
Do we need it from an ethical perspective? No. From a legal perspective? Yes, absolutely.
So what would it take to include civility on performance reviews?
You really just need statements that say, are respectful to others, treat others respectfully.
Checking off one extra box could change the lives of many. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Lilia Fuchen.
Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, where your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast awaits you. And if you like the podcast, write a review, pass it on, and tell a friend. As we know, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.